It's Central Time. I'm Rob Barrett. You're with us here on the Ideas Network. Over the last 25 years, an estimated 40 million Americans have stopped attending church. There are lots of different reasons, ranging from a lack of time or motivation to leaving deliberately because of negative experiences or loss of faith. Now, for the first time in history, the number of Americans who never go to church is outpacing the number who attend weekly. According to our next guest, this large-scale unchurching isn't just a concern for individual congregations or denominations that are losing membership. It's a change that can hold up a mirror to American politics and society. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Love to hear your story. Did you regularly attend a worship service? Maybe every week? Has that declined? What led to that? Or have you left altogether? If you're still going, are you seeing empty pews in your neighborhood more and more? What do you think might be behind that? Join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. You can also post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. Ryan Burge is an associate professor of political science at Eastern Illinois University, where he researches religion in the United States. He did the research and data analysis for a new book called The Great De-Churching. Who's leaving? Why are they going? And what will it take to bring them back? Ryan, welcome back to Central Time.
Always a pleasure to be here.
We've talked before, Ryan, on the show about your work on the nuns, N-O-N-E-S, people leaving religious affiliation. And it seems like this amazingly big social trend that for a lot of people is under the radar. Could you talk about the scale, the scope of this de-churching and where it fits into American history?
Yeah, I've been telling people that I think this is the biggest cultural shift of the last 100 years. I mean, we've never seen this many people leave institutions at the rate they're leaving. According to this book, 40 million people have de-churched over the last 25 years. That is more than the number of people who became Christian during the first and second Great Awakening and all the Billy Graham Crusades combined. So if all those gains that American history has seen towards Christianity have all basically been lost over the last two or three decades during the Great De-Churching.
When we've talked in the past, the mainstream Protestant denominations seem to be having a lot of the biggest losses, and that's been going on over time. Same with Catholics. In the new book, there's a lot of focus on research on evangelical Christianity. What are we seeing there? Are they starting to see the same kinds of trends?
Yeah, for a while, they really were exploding rapidly. In 1972, about 17% of Americans were evangelical. But around 1993, the share of Americans who are evangelical got to 30%. That's the highest it's ever been. And from that point forward, it's really been nothing but a slow and steady decline. Today in America, about 21, 22% of Americans identify as evangelical, so down 8% from their peak. And all the evidence is pointing to the fact that evangelicalism is not going to be able to, you know, resist the trend towards secularization. Obviously, you know, Catholics and mainline Protestants have lost a lot more, but evangelicalism is not nearly as strong nor as cohesive as it was in America even 20 or 30 years ago.
Now, a key point here is de-churching, no longer attending church at all or on a regular basis, isn't necessarily the same as de-faithing. And as you break down different groups of people, a lot of people who have left church may still keep at least some sort of the faith they left. Can you talk about that?
Yeah. So really what I love about this book is these two pastors, Jim Davis and Michael Graham, came to me and said, we have this idea for a book. Can you help us? Can you do the data for it? And I said, sure, I'd be happy to. So my friend Paul Jupe and I did all the data behind the scenes. They were really focused on an interesting aspect of religion that, scholars don't think about a lot. And that is not people who we think a lot about, people who used to be evangelical and now are none, for instance. This book is about people who used to attend church at least once a month or more and now describe their attendance as seldom or never, so less than once a year. And this is such an interesting aspect because sometimes people can de-church, but not de-evangelical or de-Catholic or de-mainline. They still identify as, you know, evangelical or mainline or Catholic, but they haven't gone to church in decades. So in some ways, they're still religious from a belonging perspective, but from a behavior perspective, they're not religious at all.
Let's look at some of the different categories of people and why they left church. One is, this is interesting to me, casually de-churched. We're a busy society. It can be hard to find time to hang out with our friends and family. And sometimes it sounds like for a lot of people, that church habit just sort of gradually falls by the wayside.
Yeah, that to me is the biggest takeaway from this book. And the thing that I learned more than anything else is the number one reason people de-church in America over the last 30 years is not because of politics. It's not because of theology. it's actually because they moved. Something so incredibly basic. You know, we hear these stories about these dramatic, like, I walked out of church because they took a stand on LGBTQ or abortion or women pastors or kind of these big social issues. What really happens for most people, according to this research, is they sort of slowly slide away from religion over time. There's not this like single inflection point where they were, you know, they were going every week and they stopped going at all. You know, they went every week and then they went once a month and then they went once every 2 or 3 months. And then now they're going once a year. And then all of a sudden they haven't gone in 3 or 4 years. And it's not really a conscious decision on a lot of their parts. A lot of it's just they sort of got away, got out of the habit, and just don't really feel a strong pull to get back in that habit, back to church.
We are talking to Ryan Burge about his work on this new book, The Great Dechurching, looking at this big movement, kind of under the radar for some people, about people leaving churches. The research here focuses on Christianity in particular. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Lots of callers. Let's start talking to you. Rob is with us in Wausau. Rob, hi.
How's it going?
Good. What did you want to bring up?
Well, I just wanted to kind of say that church is becoming too political, and I stay home with my children and we still have faith and I try to teach them, you know, the right way, but just the politicalness and it's just going too far.
Rob, thanks a lot for the call. And Ryan, in the book, there's two categories of people who might agree with that. People on the left, let's put that really loosely, who don't agree with their church's teaching, maybe on LGBTQ issues or abortion or Donald Trump or you name it, and people in the book described as a secular right who think the church teachings are too liberal or not political enough. Can you talk about, Rob, certainly not alone in that.
Yeah, it seems like, you know, churches can't win, right? They're too much or not enough of left or right. And I think, honestly, the perception here is different than the reality. You know, in other surveys, we've asked people who go to church every week, has your pastor spoken about any of these issues over the last 12 months from the pulpit? And we're talking everything from immigration to healthcare to abortion, you know, big issues and small issues. And one third of people say their pastor's not mentioned a single issue in the last 12 months. And 52% chose one issue or zero issue from that list of 10. So I think some of that is perception. And pastors are not dumb. They're very strategic about how they act on Sunday morning. And they realize by being political, they're feeding into Rob's problem, which is they're being too much of this thing and not enough of the other thing. Michael Jordan was once asked, why aren't you more political? And he said, because Republicans buy sneakers too. You know, pastors, they realize that if you go out on the limb on this issue to the left or this issue to the right, you're going to alienate a part of your congregation either way. And so I think a lot of pastors have tried to take the middle way and really not gone into the politics as much as they possibly can.
Thanks a lot for that call, Rob. Before we go back to our callers, I want to meet another category of people you separate out in the book who have de-churched. Ex-evangelicals.
Yeah, that's such a category online. Ex-evangelicals are people who grew up in the evangelical church. For instance, I grew up in the evangelical church, and now in the 1990s, by the way, which you look back at like the data, that's when peak evangelicalism was happening. There were more evangelicals than ever before. They're politically and culturally more were stronger than they've ever been, and now they faded a bit. But, you know, a lot of those kids now who grew up evangelical in their 30s and 40s and really thinking back on the purity culture and the gender roles and the politics, and they're the ones who not only left the evangelical church behind, they spend a lot of their time being critical of the evangelical church, have no desire to go back. They still believe in Jesus and the Bible and a lot of Christian orthodoxy. They just really dislike everything that evangelicalism represents in American culture, politics, and society.
Let's go back to our callers. Jonah is with us in Oakwood. Jonah, hi.
Hi, it's nice to be calling in.
Yeah, what did you want to tell us about Jonah?
So I grew up in the church. I was a Christian for, I guess you could say, 20 years then. I'm 24 now. And like 15 of those I remember very vividly. And the biggest thing I took away from it the entire time was not necessarily God's love or the love of my church to me, but it was the shame. That was the biggest thing that I took away. Yeah.
Jonah, can I ask what denomination, if you're willing to share that with us?
Yeah. Non-denominational, which itself is a denomination. And I think it's kind of funny that we call ourselves that.
Jonah, thanks a lot for sharing that experience. Okay, a couple big points there I want to get into, Ryan. First of all, non-denominational churches. This is one of the categories, one of the few categories that has still been growing lately, right, Ryan?
Oh, man, I think that's really the only bright spot in American Christianity right now, especially American evangelicalism, is non-denominational. So if you look at the Southern Baptists, they're down 3 million people from 2006. The Presbyterian Church USA went from 3.1 million in 1984 to 1.1 million today. You can go down the list. Almost every major denomination has suffered, you know, catastrophic losses of membership over the last 10 or 15 years. Really, the only group that's grown is non-denominationals. In the 1970s, only 3% of Americans identified as non-denominational. Almost 15% of Americans identify as non-denominational. In the future, most evangelicals are going to be non-denominational Christians, and we always think of them as evangelical. Even though not every non-denominational church is evangelical, the vast majority, the joke is they basically look like Southern Baptists without the name, you know, in terms of theology and practice and things like that. And, you know, the experience with shame is very real in the evangelical church. A lot of talk about sinfulness and judgment in the end times, and it makes you think a lot about who you are and what you're doing, and shame is definitely a part of the evangelical tradition, without a doubt.
Jonah, thanks a lot for the call. And Ryan, your co-authors in this book, the pastors, talk about walking a fine line between, you know, wanting to present a gospel of love that might appeal to someone like Jonah, but not giving up on articles of faith and saying, yeah, there are certain behaviors we really think you ought to do if you're a Christian.
That's the I've always heard that good preachers should comfort the afflicted and afflict the comfortable. And how much you do of each one of those every Sunday really depends on what the passage is, what's going on in the world. And sometimes I think pastors do a little bit too much and not enough. We all need a pat on the head and a kick in the behind every once in a while. You know, do better, be a better Christian, be a better person. We also need to know you're doing pretty good and God loves you just the way you are. It's hard to hold those two things in tension sometimes.
Thanks again for that call, Jonah. We're talking to Ryan Burge, assistant professor of political science at Eastern Illinois University. He researches religion in the U.S. We're talking about his contributions to the new book, The Great Dechurching, which looks at why many Americans have stopped going to church and what it means for the country we live in. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Are we talking about you or your congregation? Have you seen this in your life or in your church? Join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. We'll continue the conversation coming up on Central Time. This is Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. We're picking up the conversation with Ryan Burge, political scientist, about the new book, The Great Dechurching. You could join in at 800-642-1234. If you're one of the millions of Americans who stopped going to church, love to hear from you and hear your story. If you're still there and seeing empty seats, love to hear your thoughts on why that might be. Join in at 800-642-1234. Back to your calls now. Randy is with us in Madison. Randy, hello.
Good afternoon. I'm a nominal Presbyterian, so I guess I'm part of that dying breed. But I have seen, you know, shrinkage in the church when I go. I think this is a prime example of William Butler Yeats's most famous line: "The best lack all conviction; the worst are full of passionate intensity." And by this point, I've been involved in a lot of movements, political movements, you'd have to call them. And when people come around and immediately identify themselves as Christians, my hairs stand on end. Usually the Christians that we're going to be allies with don't put that up first thing.
Randy, thanks a lot for the call. Ryan, Randy pointing, I think, toward political polarization in wider American culture. How do we see that playing out in churches and whether people stay or go?
Yeah, if you look at the data, what Randy's talking about is ideas religion as a cultural and political identity, not necessarily a religious identity anymore. We're seeing the rise of the share of people who identify as evangelical but never go to church. Which is an interesting phenomenon. But the more you think about it, the more you realize they're grabbing onto that label because they like the political and cultural connotation of what the word evangelical means, even though they don't really believe in the death and resurrection of Jesus Christ, let's say. And I think that's really what we're seeing in America is that religions become almost like a totem, like a marker, almost like I root for the Yankees. Like I'm an evangelical, even though I don't really watch the games, even though I don't really go to church. because I like where that puts me in social and political space. It identifies who I'm with and who I'm against. And I think a lot of liberal Christians in America see that and go, yeah, I'm a Christian, but I'm not going to say it, because when I say Christian, the average person thinks Republican or conservative, and I'm not those things. So I won't lead with that idea. It's just interesting how in the 1980s, you know, Christians were evenly divided, Republican and Democrat, and now they're overwhelmingly Republican, especially white Christians. Now that liberal Christians have seen that, they've sort of pulled back from that identity as part of themselves.
Thanks a lot for that call. Randy at 800-642-1234. Ryan, before we go back to our callers, I want to check out another group now, a category of people leaving churches. You just mentioned white Christians. You have a category called BIPOC, the Black Indigenous People of Color. What story did you see there?
Oh, it's such an interesting story, Rob, because we used an algorithm for this, which is a computer generated, AI thing that creates these clusters. And we did not include a race variable on purpose because we didn't want it to use race. But the algorithm, for some reason, put everyone who was a person of color in our sample of dechurched evangelicals into this one cluster of BIPOC. What's really interesting about them is they have really high levels of education and really high incomes. And I wonder if a lot of the reason they're leaving is the politics that we're talking about, because white Christianity has become something else entirely compared to, you know, Christianity for people of color. Black Protestants, almost 90% of them voted for Joe Biden in 2020, when it was 80% of white evangelicals voted for Donald Trump. So I wonder if a lot of people of color who are raised in evangelical traditions have left those traditions because they want to distance themselves from the MAGA Republicans they see taking over, you know, modern evangelicalism.
Let's go back to your calls now. Bryce is with us in Wauwatosa. Bryce, hello.
Hello, good afternoon, gentlemen. Thank you so much for accepting my call. It is rather appropriate that you talk about the BIPOC aspect of your research. I am African-American. I was raised in the United Methodist Church with my father being a United Methodist pastor in Indiana for a 30-year period. I am 53 years of age, and as time has progressed and as I have gotten further away from my family, I have pretty much accepted agnosticism as my way of looking at belief at this point in my life, to comfortably say I don't know, which in a general sense, my understanding is that's what agnosticism represents. And I'm comfortable in saying that. Number two, and then I will close. In the United Methodist tradition, I'm sure your author is very well aware of this, recently there has been a seismic shift within that denomination in that the issues of LGBTQ have come to the forefront in the faith, and quite a few people are starting to leave either individually or collectively from the United Methodist faith as a result. So quite a few things are changing from whence I was a preacher's boy sitting in the front row listening to Dad give the word. Thank you all so much.
Bryce, thank you so much for sharing your personal story, first of all. And Ryan, to Bryce's second point, LGBT issues, a lot of disjuncture there between society at large and what's going on in these churches. How big a factor is that in de-churching?
So the United Methodist Church is seeing the largest denominational schism in American history right now. I don't think we're talking about this enough. It used to be 8 million people. Over 20% of those churches have disaffiliated over the last 18 months and joined what's called the Global Methodist Church, which is the more conservative branch of United Methodism now. So it's going to create an entirely new religious landscape. We are seeing a lot of young people who maybe not be LGBTQ themselves, but are allies of LGBTQ people, growing up evangelical especially, and going, I can't be part of a congregation that does not allow those people to be full members and do their weddings like they would do my heterosexual wedding. So I think there's if you even look at young evangelicals, by the way, a majority of young evangelicals, 18 to 35-year-olds, are now in favor of same-sex marriage. So it's a situation where the bottom up is overwhelmingly in favor of same-sex marriage, especially amongst non-Christian young people. But the institutions are holding true to their doctrine they preached for hundreds of years. And at some point, things are going to have to change in one way or the other as those churches continue to empty out.
Thanks again for that call. I want to talk a little about the impact of this, Ryan. Obviously, if you're a pastor, you're very worried about this. If you're a member of a church, you're very concerned. There's also concerns raised in the book about, you know, this is a great opportunity for people to participate in a community. And these are institutions that often do a lot of work, whether it's in education or health or social services. What are some of the impacts of de-churching, even for people who maybe didn't church in the first place?
Yeah, Perry Bacon wrote this great op-ed for the Washington Post a couple of weeks ago called "I Used to Be a Christian, Now I Miss Church," and where he kind of lays out this idea. He grew up in church, just like Bryce did, you know, in an African-American household, and he was there every Sunday with his dad front row. And now he doesn't believe in a lot of the doctrines, but he has a deep ache for the community and the volunteerism that church provided for him and his family. I think a lot of people forget that churches are also social organizations. They're horizontal organizations that help us connect with each other and then serve the community. And so I wonder, you know, how are we going to generate social capital in the future? Who's going to run the clothes closets and the food pantries and the soup kitchens, all the things that we're doing in these little communities across America? They're going to disappear in 20 or 30 years as the great de-churching accelerates. Who's going to fill the gaps? Who's going to step in? We obviously don't want the government to do that. Most Americans want a smaller government, not a larger one. And I love my atheist agnostic friends, but they have not shown an ability to organize these, you know, volunteer organizations in a way that can replace Christian organizations that are dying. And I worry about people on the fringes being left behind, left out, and lost because these church organizations aren't going to exist anymore.
Briefly, Ryan, is that necessarily the case? Your co-authors found room for optimism for revitalizing church communities in our last half a minute. Do you think that's a possibility?
Listen, there's always, you know, the pendulum swings both ways, right? It's really, we're moving way far towards secularization right now, but you see little green shoots in certain religious communities that are doing very well. For instance, the Orthodox Church in America is doing very well. Traditional Catholics who go back to the Latin Mass are doing very well. So I think religion's going to be remade in a different way. We're going to see new religious movements over the next 15 or 20 years, but a lot of pastors are facing issues like now, like how to get rid of their pulpits and choir robes and hymnals. And those are not easy conversations to have going forward.
Ryan, thanks as always for joining us today.
Always a pleasure.
That's Ryan Burge, assistant professor of political science at Eastern Illinois University. We've been talking about his contribution to the new book, The Great Dechurching. Who's leaving? Why are they going? And what will it take to bring them back? You can keep sharing your stories. You can email ideas@WPR.org. I'm Rob Ferret. You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. Living an active lifestyle is one way to keep ourselves healthy and mobile as we age. But as our bodies change with time, our fitness routines may have to change along with it. Our next guest is a physical therapy expert joining us with advice on how to adapt our exercise habits so we can stay active well into old age. You can join in at 800-642-1234. How have your exercise habits changed as you age? What are some activities you've been able to keep doing as you've gotten older? What are some you've left behind? Or have you found new ways to get exercise over the years or decades? Call in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or you can post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. Carlin Ault is a clinical associate professor in the Doctor of Physical Therapy program at UW-Milwaukee. Carlin, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thanks, Rob. It's my pleasure to be here.
Before we get into the how, let's talk a little bit about the why. Carlin, what are the benefits of keeping exercise going, keeping fitness going as we get older?
Well, as we age, our muscles and bones can change a little bit, and it's important to stay strong, especially in those functional muscle groups that help us get up and down off of the ground, get in and out of chairs, cars, those sorts of things. And it is true, if you don't use it, you will lose it. So it's especially important through the aging process to continue to load our muscles and bones and continue to push ourselves so we have the stimulus to add more muscle and bone.
You know, the workout my 20-year-old daughters might be doing now might not be right for me. How do we evaluate as we get older, you know, this is the appropriate thing to accomplish those goals you just lined out? This maybe isn't the thing I do anymore.
Well, it, of course, everything is individualized. If you have any underlying conditions or you're on certain medications, those things can make a difference. But you may be able to do a lot of the exercises that your 20-year-old daughter is doing. So don't sell yourself short. We want to make sure that we're continuing to strengthen our muscles. And the good news is While we have some physiological and biological changes in our tissues with aging, the good news is those tissues are still very responsive to appropriate loading. So you can add muscle mass, you can add some strength to your bone, or slow down the rate of the decline by staying active. I always like to say we all need to move more and sit less. And anything that you do is better than nothing. So that's a good place to start.
That is. Let's talk about strength a little bit. You mentioned some key muscle groups for doing things like getting up and down, things like that. What are some of the muscle groups we might focus on? What are some good entry points to exercising those zones?
Yeah, that's a great question. I focus a lot on sit to stand or being able to get up off of the floor. As we're aging, or really at any age, we can sometimes find ourselves on the floor. But as you are aging and becoming a little bit weaker, which is part of the normal aging process, is you do lose some muscle mass, to make sure you're focusing on the muscles that are used for functional tasks. So if you're sitting in a chair and you stand up, you need your glutes, which is your backside, and your quads on the front of your thigh to be able to help you lift your body weight to be able to stand up. So anything that's involving some sit to stand activities are very important for those muscle groups. Also, the outside of your hips, when we walk, we stand on one leg for part of the time and we're swinging the other leg. So making sure the outside of our leg muscles are nice and strong so we stay stable. It's all about reducing your risk of having a fall, because falls can really disrupt your life, and staying strong will allow you to be able to better able to catch yourself or prevent yourself from falling. But at least if you find yourself on the floor, you've got the muscle strength to get back up.
And then how about keeping our cardiovascular exercise going over time?
Yeah, that's another great question. So a muscle is muscle. So the heart is a muscle, and we have to exercise that just like we exercise our peripheral muscles. And the target heart rate the heart rate, you want to work hard enough that you're challenging your muscles, whether it's a muscle in your thigh or your heart muscle. So we always do need to be pushing ourselves a little bit above what our daily level of function is. For cardiovascular exercise, you want to be trying to get around 60 to 80% of your heart rate for whatever period of time you can do that for. The guideline is 150 minutes per week of moderate physical activity. So if you break that up, if you're doing a little over 30 minutes or so per day of aerobic physical activity, that is a good place to start. But you'd like to push yourself a little more than just what you're typically used to doing.
Talking to Carlin Ault, clinical associate professor at UW-Milwaukee, on physical therapy, talking about our changing exercise and fitness needs as we age. You can join in with your questions or your story at 800-642-1234. James is with us now in Fountain City. James, hi.
Hi, thanks for having me. Say, I'm 75, and I started with endurance sports, in the late 70s or so, doing Birkebeiners, cross-country ski races, all of the Midwest, and I've continued on mountain bike series. In fact, I'm on my way right now to a canoe workout, which is pretty intense canoeing since I live near Winona and the home of Winona Canoes. And plus, I'm a master swimmer. All I can say to people listening to this is you don't quit. You don't quit unless you literally can't get up off a chair, but I'm a big proponent of staying active. I mean, I lift at the Y, I do all these things. I don't know where I got that from. Must be genetics or something, but.
I think it helps if it's fun too, right? Mm-hmm. When it's a fun activity, it's a lot easier for you to go out and participate. I also think it's wonderful that you're doing a great combination of upper extremity exercises. Canoeing is going to work your arms and your upper body. Swimming is upper body. Cross-country skiing, biking, both lower extremity exercises. They'll all get your heart working with cardiovascular work, and none of them are really jarring or loading to your lower extremity joints. Some people can develop some arthritis and some pain in their hips and knees with the aging process. You don't have to, but some people do. Those individuals would tolerate something like skiing or biking better than running and jogging. So picking the type of exercise, even though it's in a category of aerobic or strength training, is important.
James, thanks a lot for sharing that. Keep it up. Now, James is a wee bit older than I am. I'm not doing anywhere near as much exercise as James is. Carlin, I do walk a fair amount. I don't know. Does walking count?
Oh, that's a great question. Walking can count for general exercise outside. So if you're walking at a pace where you're starting to breathe a little bit heavier, you can carry on a conversation, but you're not huffing and puffing. That's probably moderate intensity. And there's nothing wrong with doing that if your goal is to get outside, work your heart muscle a little bit. If you wanted to be making your bones stronger or adding mass to your muscles, you would need to do something a little bit more than that. Doesn't mean that walking's not good. It means you can maybe mix and match different activities so you can accomplish all the goals that you're looking for. For adding some strength to your bones, you really need a little more impact. So you could walk maybe with trekking poles and you'd be pounding your poles into the pavement while you're walking. That would be more of an impact load, if that makes sense.
Sure. Let's go to another caller now. Lyric is with us in Blanchardville. Lyric, hi.
Hi. A few years ago, I got injured and had a brain concussion, and the best medicine for me was that walking in water the Upland Hills and Dodgeville has, where you walk across the floor to an area and it lowers down into a pool that's about 9 feet wide and maybe 16 feet long. The water, if your knees or your ankles are injured, the water supports your body weight. And in front of you is a bar that you can hang on if you've got a balance problem, so you feel very safe. You can tell them how high you want the jets of water that are moving in the pool and how deep you want it. But my favorite thing was that the endorphins that your body gets when you're walking in that water is like the best antidepressant in the world, and it lasts 2 or 3 days at least. It's wonderful.
Lyric, thank you so much for sharing that. And that's, Carlin, for people who can't have a lot of impact, that could be a great option, it sounds like.
That is a great option. And she's absolutely right that when you can participate in an activity that makes you feel good and you do have the endorphin release, you know you're doing something positive for your body. But when it's fun and it's enjoyable, you're going to stick with it. And of course, for all of us, that's the real trick, is being able to find something that we can continue to do because it's fun and we enjoy it and it makes us feel good.
Lyric, thanks a lot for sharing that at 800-642-1234. We're talking to Carlin Ault, clinical professor of physical therapy at UW-Milwaukee, about how to adapt our exercise habits, our fitness routines, as we get older to help keep us mobile and healthy. And you can join in at 800-642-1234. What goals do you have for remaining active as you age? Are there recreational or practical activities that you're worried about having to leave behind? Our guest might be able to help you find something that could replace it. Join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. We'll pick up the conversation, maybe hear from you, coming up on Central Time. Central Time, I'm Rob Ferret. We continue our conversation with Carlin Ault, Clinical Associate Professor of Physical Therapy at UW-Milwaukee. We're talking about how we can change our workout, our fitness routine as we get older, so we can continue to live active and healthy lives. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Are you a lifelong exerciser? How did that change over the years, if at all? Have you hit an age where you're thinking, I got to start doing some stuff? Because you have a sedentary normal person job like radio host. I don't know. Join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Back to your calls now. Jim is with us in Juneau. Jim, hello.
Hello. Yes, thanks for taking the call. Anyways, I'm 60 this year, and during COVID, I tried seeing what retiring would look like, and I can't do it. And so I gave up my job that I had, and now I'm back into construction. I'll tell you what, it was hard getting going, but daggone it, I've never felt this good in my life. You know,
Jim, did you do exercise, apart from the exercise involved in the construction work itself? Like, were you doing stuff to build up to that?
Yeah. During the winter, I went ahead because they don't hire in the winter. So during the winter, I got a membership at the Y, and I made sure that I was, you know, doing the treadmills, walking the block around here, lifting a little weight to try and make sure that I wasn't going to strain something right out the gate. But, yeah.
I love it, Jim. Thanks a lot for sharing that story. Carl, it sounds like Jim was really smart about getting back into construction work there.
Yeah. Yes, construction is certainly a physical job that will keep you using your muscles most definitely. One comment I do want to add to what Jim said is that the target, if most of us are going to the gym and working on muscle strengthening, we want to make sure that we're working hard enough that we're going to get some benefit out of it. And that is, in physical therapy term, we'd be looking at like 60 to 80% of your one rep max, meaning the most that you can lift. But that's a little complicated for most of us to do when we go to the gym. But if you think about it in the number of repetitions you could do on an exercise, if I'm doing bicep curls to make my bicep, my upper arm stronger, I should be lifting a weight that's heavy enough that by the time I get to number 10, I could almost not do one more repetition. If I'm aiming for 10 repetitions, I'm probably at about 75% of my one rep max, which means I'm going to be giving my body a stimulus to add more muscle, add more protein. Anywhere between 8 and 12 is good, but 10 is kind of around that sweet spot. So that might help people is if you can do 30 and you think you're adding muscle mass, you need to push yourself a little harder with a heavier weight, so you can't do quite so many reps. That's the stimulus to add your muscle. And I'm sure that Jim is doing that when he's working construction, lifting heavy loads.
Jim, thanks a lot for sharing your story at 800-642-1234. Kenny is with us now in Rice Lake. Kenny, hi. Were you there, Kenny?
Yeah.
Hi. What did you want to tell us about?
I'm a welder by trade, and oftentimes in the shop I work in, I hear from the gentleman my age or in our 60s that all you need to do is work hard, and that's going to help you stay in good shape. When I've learned over the years that I like to go to the gym and work out and ride bicycle and do aerobic activities, and it seems to keep you in much better shape than just, quote, working hard.
All right. And Kenny, have you talked your coworkers into going biking with you or hitting the gym with you?
Boy, you know, they just don't seem to be really responsive to that. They don't want to jump in and go to the spin class at the gym, but maybe they will.
All right. Tell them we sent you, Kenny. Thanks a lot for sharing that story. Carlin, again, Kenny seems to be on the right track here.
Yeah, we have. Well, of course, we have wonderful listeners on public radio. They're
yes.
They're all exercising. Terrific.
Kenny, thanks for the call. Carlin, one zone of exercise we haven't talked about a ton yet, related to you were talking about falls earlier, is balance. Now, when people are in their teens and 20s, they might not be thinking about balance as an exercise issue. Why does that get important? What can we do about it?
Balance is really important. Single leg balance, because if you think about standing at home and getting dressed, you're standing on one leg and have to put your leg through the other leg of the pant, or you have to sit down to be able to do that. So balance is important for walking, for transitions, for slippery surfaces. Often, you know, getting up from sit to stand, you might have been dozing and you're startled. It's a real it's a danger zone when you're making transitions between sit to stand, and that does relate to balance. In addition to just having good muscle strength and the ability to kind of take all of your weight, our vision changes, our hearing changes. We might have a lot of wax built up in our ears. The vestibular system and your visual system also play a role in balance. I often think of getting up to go to the bathroom at night. If your house is completely dark, you have taken away, you're a little bit groggy, and you've taken away that visual system from being able to help you with your balance. So I'm a big fan of nightlights for the aging population, so that as you take away some of those other supports for you to maintain good balance, vision and your vestibular system, that you've you're supporting yourself if you've got any changes in diabetes or poor range of motion in your legs that can affect your balance.
Talking to Carlin Alt from UW-Milwaukee, physical therapist there, talking about our changing exercise and fitness needs as we age. Back to your calls now with Kim in Mequon. Hi, Kim.
Hi, how are you doing?
Good. What's your story?
Well, I have been a lifelong exerciser. I am 69 this year. I still downhill ski, cross-country ski, ride my bike. I mean, I started riding a bike in my teens. I have three bikes. I still ride them. I rode my bike to work today and back. And my job is teaching fitness classes for seniors. So I cannot tell you how many times I've had someone come to the classes new and start working out. We do weight training. We do a little cardio. And they will come back to me like 3 or 4 months later and say, hey, I just went to my doctor, and my doctor's like, what are you doing? Keep it up. Your blood pressure's down. You know, your stats are really, really good. So I just want to say, if anybody is a little older and hasn't worked out for a long time, don't let that stop you, because you can get back into the game.
Kim, thanks a lot for the call and the inspiration. Carlin, Kim pointing toward the, like, even within a few months, apparently doctors noticing a difference when people get back into exercise.
Yeah, and absolutely. And there are some studies that will show that even into your 90s, you can add muscle mass. So that the body is very adaptive. And so you can start at any age and you will see changes. It does take... you know, 6 weeks at least to start to get muscle mass changes, but you can see improvement sooner than that. It's more of a neuromuscular training effect, but absolutely, you can see physical changes, body changes, strength, endurance changes, and you just overall, you feel better. And I will put in a little plug for protein, because as we age, the body's ability to, the amount of protein that we need to take in to help build our muscles, that changes a little bit. So everyone, but especially our older adults, need to be eating protein with just about every meal, because that's helping to maintain that muscle health and muscle strength.
Kim, thanks again for the call and the inspiration. Carlin, you mentioned, you know, people may have some different needs when it comes to exercise. I wanted to ask you about one of your specialties. You work with people on exercise and fatigue for survivors of cancer. What kind of different things might be at play there?
Well, cancer itself and all of the treatments for cancer can affect multiple systems in the body, can affect your heart muscle, so cardiovascular system. You can have a loss of extensibility, so things end up getting a little bit tight, can have some changes in your bone. So all systems can be affected either through cancer and or cancer treatment. And for some reason, we tend to not, we meaning the medical system, don't always routinely refer our patients who are undergoing or have completed treatment for cancer to physical therapy to get people back strength, muscle strength, cardiovascular conditioning. We don't do it in the same way that we do for heart attacks or for strokes or amputations. And that's really my mission, is to make sure that all cancer survivors, because there's millions of them, are treated with specific exercise to help people return back to a highly functional life. It's not just about surviving the treatment. It's about returning to thriving and having a really high quality of life, being strong and being able to enjoy every day because you do feel good.
Carlin, we'll leave it there. Thanks so much for joining us today.
Okay, thank you.
That's Carlin Alt, Clinical Associate Professor of Physical Therapy at UW-Milwaukee. We talked to her today about how we can change our workout and fitness routines as we get older to help keep us active, hopefully for years to come. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Barrett. Many religions and spiritual groups have rules or traditions when it comes to food, whether it's certain foods or periods of time one shouldn't eat or specific recipes we could associate with a place of worship. Our beliefs can often influence our meals. You might not know some of the religious or spiritual history behind some common foods you find at the grocery store today. In a new book, our next guest digs into the historical connections between American faith and food. You can join in at 800-642-1234. How do your beliefs influence what you eat or don't eat? Are there certain foods you associate with your religion or maybe what you eat after a worship session? Did you have a church cookbook or other food tradition involving your place of worship? Join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email ideas@WPR.org. Christina Ward is a Milwaukee-based writer and editor who's vice president of the publishing company Feral House. Her latest book is called Holy Food, How Cults, Communes, and Religious Movements Influenced What We Eat and American History. Christina, welcome back to Central Time.
Oh, thank you so much for having me. I'm so excited to talk about this.
Now, you write in the book that you get asked this a lot, but I'm still going to ask you, what led you down this path? I think it's not a connection a lot of people would immediately leap at, to the connection between faith and food.
Right. I think I put it down to growing up in Milwaukee and then being exposed to a lot of people. Public schools are great. You get to meet folks from different kinds of backgrounds and learn a little bit about what they believe. But it was spending the summers on my grandmother's very rural farm in Jackson County. And it was like the late 70s. And I remember there was an itinerant preacher that came along and was going to take all the kids to a tent revival. And it was kids only. And it makes more sense as an adult that every farm in the area sent their kids. And you got a reward, a little bit of an ice cream sundae if you answered the questions correctly about the Bible. And that, I think, for me, really cemented this idea that food and religion are intertwined and that they can, the food can also serve a purpose for believers.
Part of the story in your book is about food, but a big part of it is also about various new religious movements throughout American history. Now, some of us might think, oh, you know, the 60s, we saw all these new traditions and spiritual awakenings and things like that. I learned from your book, I kind of knew it, but you really spelled it out. This has been a constant in the United States. We're like a laboratory for the creation of new religious and spiritual traditions. Can you talk about that a little before we dig more into the food?
Yeah, absolutely. The United States, it has essentially a trifecta. There's three big elements that help essentially foster an environment where people feel comfortable about exploring different avenues of worship, of religion. And that is our first, of course, the First Amendment. We don't have a state religion. We don't, you know, have a national religion, whereas many countries, especially in Europe, have a national state religion. And that keeps the belief systems fairly intact. The United States does not have that. And our tax laws are very generous to religious organizations, because primarily when those tax laws were put into place, churches were mainly responsible for the social services that were required to keep a community going. And then, of course, the third thing is our own history of being settled by being occupied by kind of religious fundamentalists.
Some of the common themes that come up again and again, a lot of traditions when it comes to their food end up avoiding meat completely or partially. And that's, some come out of European Christian traditions. Some are coming out of or inspired by, say, Hinduism or Buddhism. Why does vegetarianism keep coming up in so many different new religious movements in the United States?
Especially the ones that are rooted in the Christian tradition, they skim and they thoroughly read the Bible. And, you know, and that's, again, the Old Testament of the Bible is something that the Islam, Judaism, and Christianity all follow. And so the idea of the Kashrut, the Leviticus, those rules, those laws are culturally embedded in all of the main religious traditions. But the new religious groups started digging further, and they found a passage in Genesis, and that's very early on, that essentially said that God created plants, seeds, and fruits to be the human food, and therefore human diets should be entirely plant-based.
And so that's the Christian tradition. And but it seems like other sources of vegetarianism found fertile ground in new religious movements in America, too.
Absolutely. And in a lot of the times in the Hindu tradition, there's a concept called ahimsa, and my apologies for my bad pronunciation. And it's a concept that means do no harm, kill no living thing, plants included. And on that spectrum, you'll get varying degrees of vegetarianism and veganism. And it's why many people following Hinduism don't eat meat at all, because killing a creature, killing a living being to make food for yourself would be against the belief system. And at the extreme, many groups like Jainism, they believe even further that you can only eat plants that are regenerative. So if, for example, an apple is okay because the tree produces it and it falls to the ground. Spinach, because you can clip it and it keeps the plant alive. So anything that doesn't kill the actual plant, whereas like a carrot, you eat a carrot, you pull it out of the ground, that carrot is, you know, essentially dead. So there's always a spectrum in how people interpret the rules and how they apply them.
Talking to Christina Ward, Milwaukee-based writer, about her new book, Holy Food, How Cults, Communes, and Religious Movements Influenced What We Eat and American History. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Maybe to share your own story of a connection between food and faith. That's 800-642-1234. Now, Christina, there's a lot of history in the book. There's also a lot of recipes in the book. You're literally looking at all these different faith traditions, big and small. What kind of recipes were you looking for to represent all these diverse religious movements?
I wanted recipes that, one, would taste good if you made them. Of course, you know, there's subjective.
There were some
taste
rejects
issues
out there, I imagine.
There were a lot of rejects. It takes a while for essentially like new vegetarians as a concept to kind of come up to speed when all you know is a very heavy meat-based diet. So these cookbooks and these recipes that the groups published really helped new believers get on the right path for the dietary system. And they also acted as an attractant to new believers. If you picked up an SDA, you know, a Seventh-day Adventist cookbook, you might be more interested in learning about the belief system. And I felt it was important for people to not just read about the food and the groups, but also maybe to try and get a taste of how they ate.
Speaking of Seventh-day Adventists, I'm from Michigan. And there was a little over 100 years ago, a Seventh-day Adventist spa that started with a lot of health treatments, including a lot of enemas and things like that. And it was led by a fellow by the last name of Kellogg. And I eat the descendants of his products all the time. Can you talk about the religious origin of our breakfast cereals shelves at the grocery store?
Yeah, absolutely. And there's, again, it's that convergence of tax laws and, you know, the idea of food and helping the believers and helping people find the right dietary path. And so at the Kellogg Sanitarium, what Kellogg was doing was using Seventh-day Adventist principles about no stimulants of any kind. And the Seventh-day Adventists didn't eat spicy food at all. They felt like even like black pepper was too spicy and would provoke temper. And so it was a time period of a couple things, of really heavy diets in starch. And I'm going to say it, it made people constipated. And so the sanitarium spent a lot of time, Dr. Kellogg, of trying to help people poop. And so a lot of the diet is about really being a little bit more healthy and getting clean on the inside and clean on the outside, because the body is a temple.
And Little Debbie snack cakes too.
Yeah. The Little Debbie snack cake started, they originally used carob and not chocolate. And when the Seventh-day Adventists sold the company, I think in the early 80s, they use chocolate. But if you grew up earlier than that, you might remember the odd taste of those, because they used carob instead of chocolate, kind of a mix. But the first one was the oatmeal cake. And again, it followed all of the principles that the Seventh-day Adventists recommended for their diet. And it made it easy. And because the tax laws said that you could, as a church, as a religious organization, create and sell products that followed your mission. And that's why we saw in the United States a lot of these groups become entrepreneurial, both in publishing cookbooks and creating products that you see on the grocery shelves today.
We're talking to Milwaukee-based author Christina Ward about her new book. It's called Holy Food, How Cults, Communes, and Religious Movements Influenced What We Eat and American History. Still time for you to join in at 800-642-1234. Is there a food you associate with your faith or belief system? Something you eat maybe in the church basement after the service or after a wedding? Or is there a food you associate with funerals or memorials? Join in at 800-642-1234 with your thoughts, experiences, or questions for our guest. That's 800-642-1234. You can also email ideas@WPR.org. We'll pick up the conversation coming up on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. We continue our talk with Christina Ward, writer and editor from Milwaukee, with us today to talk about her new book, Holy Food, How Cults, Communes, and Religious Movements Influenced What We Eat in American History. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Do you see connections between food and religious or spiritual beliefs in your life? What questions do you have about the history of food and religion in the U.S.? Join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Christina, Johnny Appleseed, I've heard the legends. Johnny Appleseed was real and had a very spiritually based mission in planting those seeds. Can you tell that story?
Yes, absolutely. So John Chapman was a follow of what's called a Swedenborgian religion, and after the Swedish scientist. And again, they were vegetarians and extreme in the sense that they really believed some of that idea of do no harm, kill no plants. And so why that's important to Johnny Appleseed is he had perfected a methodology of starting apple trees from seed, whereas so often people starting orchards were doing that by grafting. And Swedenborg and the believers of that and Chapman felt that that was harming the tree, and that was not a good way to start apple farms. And he traveled west throughout the frontier of the country, essentially teaching how to plant apples from seed. Why that's so important is this is the days before water filtration, and finding drinkable water was really critical. And people of that time period didn't always drink straight water. What they were drinking was cider, was drinking what they call small beer, essentially a fermented liquid. And the apples were super critical to creating a cider and creating a liquid that was going to keep people alive.
Now, another theme that pops up in different decades, different faith traditions, Christina, in your book is the idea of opening a restaurant. In some cases, offering free food to bring people into a service. In some cases, as a money-making opportunity, often relying on cheap or free labor of parishioners. Talk about some of the examples where we saw religion turn into restaurant.
It's funny because a few that were started in the 1920s are still operating today. And that's the United House of Prayer for All People that they still offer as part of their service. And primarily they're in the southeast of the United States. There's a great one in DC and in New York. And they offer a cafeteria style, which is great kind of Southern style soul food. And that, again, is part of the practice. It is becomes a service to the community because it's very low price. And it's an opportunity for the organization, for the group to earn a revenue, to earn some money to keep their organization going. And of course, very few actually go outwardly proselytizing to try to recruit new members, but they always have material available so you can learn more. One of the modern ones too, you might see, is Vegan Hut. Vegan Hut, Loving Hut Vegan is part of a new religious movement. And so again, they started these restaurants to help generate revenue, do community service, and recruit new members.
A bigger scale example, the Unification Church, run by the late Sun Myung Moon, people derisively call them Moonies sometimes, a huge player in the raw fish for sushi industry.
Yes, they are the providers of almost, I think it's 80% of the sushi fish in the United States. What's most interesting, I think, about the Unification Church's is business is that because it is a bit of a closed group, with kind of high standards for their moral behavior of their members who are then also working in the industry, is they've associated with another group to do the transportation. So the Nation of Islam, in a long tradition of training truck drivers and some longshoremen, often work very closely with the Unification Church to help transport that fish. And so that's a really great example of two new religious movements, a little on the extreme side for both, working together to help support each other and their food businesses.
Talking to Christina Ward about her new book, Holy Food, How Cults, Communes, and Religious Movements Influenced What We Eat and American History. Christina, the word cults is in the title there. There's debate over what exactly constitutes a cult. But all that said, there are cases where these things take a darker turn, where food is used in some ways as a way of control, of regulating the lives of members of faith. What were some of the more worrisome stories you ran into?
Absolutely. So, you know, to be clear, a cult is something, a group that has a high control. They're controlling how you think, how you feel, what information can come into your life, as well as some autonomy, bodily control. And that's where the food comes in, about how to control the body. Many of the really high control groups with terrible outcomes often recommended fasting, extreme fasting, or would withhold food as a punishment. I'm thinking, or as a pressure test. Yogi Bhajan, who founded the Happy, Holy, Healthy organization and famously wouldn't let people join the group until they did a 3-day garlic fast. And it wasn't so much of a fast as a test. You had to eat garlic for breakfast, lunch, and dinner, one clove, for 3 days. And if you could do that, it sent a signal to Bhajan that you were open, you were receptive to following pretty inane directions. And then he knew that that was someone he wanted in his group because they were more controllable.
You also write about foods associated with death and funerals and memorials. Now, there are, I think, foods that people often will bring to that wake or whatever. There were some more closely associated foods that literally you held the food over the deceased, often in a coffin or similar situation. Can you talk about some of those death foods?
And this is a much earlier tradition, so we don't see it much in the 20th century at all. And it's really born out of some of the European folk traditions that then got incorporated into the Christianity. And it's primarily what you see is in the Christian beliefs. And so you hear things in the Dutch have a dudkoeks, which is dead cakes. And they were essentially a cookie that memorialized the person who died that people traditionally would eat afterwards. In Wales, they have proper like death cakes and sin eaters, where essentially you'd make a cake and that would represent all of the sins of the person and then consume it and have a designated person consume it. And they were essentially eating the sins of that person, freeing that person to go to heaven. In Bavaria, there was tradition of, again, of putting a cake on the actual corpse for a bit and then consuming it. And you'll see this, it's almost a form of cannibalism. And that's what anthropologists will tell you. And essentially, you're getting that power. You get the power of the person. You're helping absolve them of sins by participating in these rituals of associating the food and death.
I want to check out one of the historical figures you talk about in the book, George Washington Carver. We know him as a scientist, big in developing different forms of agriculture. But you point out something I didn't know. A lot of his work was driven by his faith. What were some of the connections?
Carver... Again, I look at him as a genius. In all of my research, I'm convinced that more people need to know about George Washington Carver and not just the peanut part. Mm-hmm. He was a brilliant scientist in botany and plants. And what he did was inspired. He felt he heard the voice of God, and he explored, as many people did in the earliest 20th century, not one particular spiritual pathway or joining a church, but many, and being open. And so he was at times a Baptist. He was at times following kind of his own spirituality based on what he was reading and the influences around him. And he felt that his work was necessary and driven by God, who told him that the plants would speak to him and that he really needed to serve his people, and his people being Black people, and trying to teach them to be as self-sufficient as possible. And one of the ways to self-sufficiency, of course, is controlling your own food supply.
And a lot of what he did ends up in food we still eat today. Can you talk about some of the foods, some of them from Africa, I believe, that he helped turn into a part of our agriculture?
Right. So if we think about what is often referred to as the Black Belt, and that is a super soil-rich area in the South, and it's primarily where a lot of enslaved people were kept enslaved. But because that plantation system, it's a monoculture, and it depleted the soils. So in that post-Civil War era, those were soils that weren't great for growing food for the people that were now living there. And so Carver, using plant sources that had long been cultivated by the enslaved people that had come to the United States that they had smuggled from Africa, were great at what's called nitrogen fixing. So he was using cowpeas and using these legumes to not just grow food, but to replenish the soil so it could grow food. And that those breakthroughs, we still use those today.
And briefly, Christina, you gathered recipes from over 200 years of faith traditions. Is there one that you've latched onto that's part of your personal food tradition now?
Well, I've got a sweet tooth, so I have to say that right away. So I'm always going to go for the things that are sweeter.
Sam.
There's a group from the 1970s, and they were a UFO / Buddhist / Hindu / pretty much everything kind of cult. And it's called the Sunburst Bakery. And they have a recipe for an apple corn cookie. And it's naturally gluten-free. They didn't intend it to be. That's just how they made it. And it's delicious. That's one of my go-to favorites. I've been making it without even telling people because it's just such a good cookie.
Christina, thanks so much for joining us today.
Thank you so much for having me. And I hope people think about their own food and religion.
That's Christina Ward. Her new book is Holy Food, How Cults, Communes, and Religious Movements Influence What We Eat and American History. Stick around. There's more to come here on Central Time.